Hello, you are listening to Unst Bespoke Sound on Resonance 104.4 FM, broadcasting in London and also available on the World Wide Web, www.resonancefm.com. And we are very pleased today to welcome into the studio Alvin Lucier, the legendary, if you don't mind me saying so, American composer. And we're going to be presenting a live in the studio performance of his famous 1969-1970 piece called I Am Sitting in a Room. And Alvin has reworked the text specifically for this occasion, so it'll be a unique and custom-made version of the piece. So welcome to Unst, Alvin.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about the piece and how it originally came to be in its first version.
Well, I was in the 1960s, end of the 60s, and I was looking for something. You know, I had lost interest and faith in the music I'd been doing earlier, which was based on European models, I guess. And there was in the air at that time the idea of investigating acoustical properties of things, the natural characteristics of sound waves and so forth. And I met a friend of mine, a scientist, who had told me about a talk he had been to at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, by a loudspeaker designer where they simply, to test their speakers, would recycle some white noise or some of the test sound material into the room to see how flat their loudspeakers were as the process continued. And I just took that as an interesting experiment to work with. And I went into a room and recorded some fragments of my speech and then rewound the tape. That was in the old days. We had audio tape. And played it back into the room, and interesting things began to happen. The acoustic properties of the room began to impinge their properties or characteristics on the speech. And pretty soon the speech gets eliminated and the resonant frequencies of the room become reinforced. I thought it was a beautiful sound and a beautiful process. So I decided to make a piece where that would be what the end result would be to reveal the acoustic properties of whatever room I did the tape recording in.
And the other night you told a story about when your daughter was in the third grade and she came with some of her classmates you went to them, or
right,
they came to you, and you were showing them some of your works and how you made your music and the kinds of sonic things that you were interested in. Mm-hmm. And you said that one of the little third graders raised their hand, mm-hmm, and said to you, "Who told you could do this?"
Right.
So who did tell you could do this?
Well, I think David Tudor and John Cage did. Mm-hmm. I remember this was also at MIT. One night in the middle of a big storm, we all went to MIT to hear David and John perform, and it just struck me that they were doing their music, whereas my teachers were waiting for somebody to do their music. You know, they were waiting for the Boston Symphony to ask them to play their symphonies. And it seemed like that wasn't going to happen. Or if it did happen, it happened very infrequently. And John and David, with whatever cheap equipment and cables and loudspeakers they could find, would make these wonderful concerts out of nothing. And that was very inspiring.
And was this... This seems maybe like the model for the Sonic Arts Union that you formed with Gordon Mumma and Robert Ashley and David Berman.
Absolutely. We saw these performances and we set out to do the same thing. We weren't a group in the sense that we played together. We played each other's works. Mm. So we all were separate composers, but we would pool equipment, and we gave hundreds of concerts.
Mm-hmm. And how did the four of you find each other, you know?
I was at Brandeis, and I had met David Behrmann in Germany at Armstadt. I was a choral conductor. I conducted a concert at Town Hall in New York of Morton Feldman and Earl Brown. And Gordon and Bob came from Ann Arbor to hear that concert. And they invited the Brandeis Chamber Chorus to Ann Arbor to perform on their one festival. And I heard both their works, and it just seemed to me something new, some new spirit that Bob and Gordon had, which came out of a particularly independent, sort of tough Midwestern idea. I don't know quite what that means, but it didn't have anything to do with any other music I had ever heard. And I admired it a lot. So I got Gordon, Bob, David, and I to do a concert in the Rose Art Museum at Brandeis. And the concert was a disaster. The electronics didn't work. The amplifiers got unplugged and so forth. But it didn't seem to bother us. And after the concert, Bob and I got together and decided to send them some letters to friends in Europe, and we got a bunch of concerts, and it started from there.
Hmm. So part of what appealed to you about the way they were doing their work was that they were making it happen for themselves and not waiting around.
Absolutely. They had a studio out there, an independent studio for electronic music, which had barely any equipment. It's what they could scrounge up. It was wonderful. And the University of Michigan, I don't mean to say anything about University of Michigan, but they you know, it was closed and you couldn't get in and so forth, whereas Bob and Gordon's studio was open to anybody.
And did you ever perform I'm Sitting in a Room as part of any of these concerts?
Yes, I used to do the tape. The original version was about 20 minutes long, and I would play it at concerts. I mean, we were against the idea of playing things that, I mean, we were, I can't think of the words, we performed our works. Mm-hmm. We didn't play tapes exactly. But in this case, I thought the only way to do this piece was play the tape. Now, if I'd thought about it a little more, I would have made a loop, a live tape loop, which I've done, where I could recite the text, record it on a loop. The loop would move across the space, get played back on another machine, and get pre-recorded again. But I didn't think of that at that time. I don't know why I didn't, but I didn't.
But you have subsequently performed it that way?
I've performed it that way. So it's a little bit hard to do because things happen. You know, the volumes are not correctly. We played it in Geneva with wonderful Studer machines, and they were so good that the one machine sensed there was a tension problem, because of course the tape loop is stretched across the room 30 feet, and it sensed there was something wrong with the tension and stopped the recording. So the equipment was so good it didn't really work right. So it's a dangerous piece to do live.
That'll teach you to use good equipment. And that would seem to bring in another element too, if you're doing it in front of an audience, that you get sounds that aren't simply your voice, but you get other.
Yeah, we had a cough every once in a while, but then the room eliminates that.
Mm.
So that's interesting to hear. You hear an extraneous sound, and after three or four iterations, that sound is gone.
Right. Have you ever performed it live where someone in the audience wanted to get in on the piece? And
No. That has never happened.
Oh, a tribute to the people who come to see your concerts.
Yeah.
That's good. And have you ever done it before on the radio, as we're about
not,
to do
not,
now?
Not this way, no.
Okay, so that, so a world premiere in a, of a
well,
sort.
Well, let's see how it works.
Yeah. Well, it's a world premiere whether it works or not.
Yeah, sure.
It could be a world premiere.
Idea, even if it doesn't work, you know, the intention to try it is very important. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Rather than say, well, it's not safe, let's not do it, then you never do it. So let's go that way.
Okay, well, let's go that way. So we'll perform I'm Sitting in a Room with Alvin Lucier here in the studio at Resonance. And we'll come back and talk about how it went when all is said and done.